Today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. We are the Atheist Nomads, bringing you history, science, politics, religion, and interviews with leaders in the atheist community. Not all those who wander are lost. Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. This is episode 23, recorded on March 9, 2013, for release on March 21, 2013. Later in the episode, we'll be joined by Jose Alvarado, who's the organizer of the Chicago Latino Atheists, and we'll be getting to hear a little bit about the Latino/Hispanic atheist kind of sub-movement, if you wanted to call it that, or at least sub-community. And so definitely looking forward to that. I'm Dustin, and joining me as always is Wesley.
Hey there, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
I'm doing pretty fucking good. You know what? Today's my birthday.
Oh,
as of the release day of the show, I'm a year older. That's right. It's a special day for some unknown reason.
Well, happy birthday, Wesley. May you enjoy celebrating the anniversary of the Earth returning to its point in its orbit around the sun where it was at the moment you exited your mother.
Awesome. It's appreciated. I already have the plan of taking tomorrow, the 22nd, off for recovery purposes.
That is quite wise. I don't get the people that take their birthday off work.
Yeah.
That's totally backwards. Work on your birthday, take the day after.
Yeah.
That is so much smarter.
Yeah, fuck it. It's not like I really have stuff to do during the day, so why not just sleep in the day after?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, perfect.
Sleep in / sleep off the hangover.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you know what? I'm not really one for hangovers.
Yeah.
Just pop a few Motrin and a couple good glasses of water before I sleep. I'm good.
Helps. Yeah, that definitely does help. I'll be sure to be doing that tonight. Night we're recording. Yeah. Since Cosmos tomorrow, we've got a party at the Idaho Discovery Center, which is going to include a trip for some of us through the Bodies exhibit.
Hmm.
Yeah. Bodies is in Boise, so very excited about that. Get to see lots of dismantled people.
that actually sounds really cool.
Yeah, yeah. This exhibit's been going around the world, and you know, we're talking major international museums. And I'm wondering how much of it did they bring to Boise? Because I don't imagine the Discovery Center having as much space as, say, you know, a museum in New York or London. But yeah, definitely looking forward to it. Might have to talk about it next time we record.
Yeah, definitely.
But one thing that was interesting for me this week, Monday, I actually spoke to a middle school class, 7th grade social studies, on world religions.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I know the teacher, and it was in the curriculum that she had to cover in her class. She knows virtually nothing on the topic. The state provides no resources to cover the topic. And I was the subject matter expert she knew, or closest thing to one. So, yeah, I had a fun time. I was two class periods. And, yeah, I had a fun time telling them about all the different world religions.
Huh. I'll be damned.
Yeah, it was interesting because there was times where this one student in particular would be like, wait, so when you die, you're actually reincarnated? And my response would just be, well, that's what Buddhists and Hindus and some other groups believe. But does it really happen? Well, if you ask them, they would say that it does. And it was really interesting to try to just keep it to, you know, the historical development and beliefs of these religions as opposed to actually making any judgment calls on any of it, because I made a very, very concerted effort to stay completely neutral.
Did any of the kids get creative and ask you what you believed?
They were ordered by their teacher beforehand to not do that. So that same student, he waited till after class and then started asking me some questions. And he kind of baited me into one, but I stayed out of the other one.
Hey, so a seventh grader got the best of you a little bit, huh?
He wanted to know what my thoughts were on exorcisms. I said, well, generally it's just a misdiagnosed psychological disorder, and you'd probably be a lot better off seeing a... Actually, you would be a lot better off seeing a shrink than going to your local exorcist, but this kid's... It was a Catholic kid who... His life dream is to be an exorcist for the Catholic Church.
Oh, come on. As far as jobs go, that would be pretty interesting.
Yeah. But it was pretty cool. Those kids were quite interesting. It turned out it was the trouble kids that made it the most interesting for me, because they were the ones that actually wanted to participate, that would ask questions and make comments. And it was a lot of fun. I definitely enjoyed it.
Nice.
Yeah. Ended up making for a really, really long day, though. I opened at work before that, went back into work after it. It was about 45 minutes away, yeah. And then had Cosmos after that. I'd left work left home at like 5:20 in the morning and didn't get back until 9:30 at night.
Not bad.
Yeah.
That's a Tuesday for me.
Yeah?
No. boy. That's cool, though, man. Fucking A. Wow. So any chance of you doing that in the future for other classes?
She'll probably bring me back for next year when that comes back, assuming I'm still in the area. It was pretty cool. I have to say, before I actually got up there, and it's like this with any kind of an audience for me. I might be a little nervous about the audience, but once I actually get going, I relax and I'm fine. But beforehand, that was the most nerve-wracking audience I've ever had. The most intimidating.
Yeah, I could totally see that. I mean, you have no common ground with them anymore.
I've spoken before hundreds of people before. prayed before 2,000. Been on podcasts with 50,000 downloads. And yeah, getting in front of a classroom of seventh graders was terrifying by comparison. Part of it could have been the very conservative little farming town it was, and the risk that they might literally, well, if I misspoke and they reported back to their parents something I'd said that I shouldn't have, that I might literally have people coming at me with pitchforks.
Oh, boy.
Pitchforks and tractors. Don't have any feedback this time around, but then again, we are recording... What, 3 days after releasing the last episode?
Yeah. Vance, where are you, man? Need some feedback. All right.
Or, Gary, you could actually say something as opposed to just hitting the like button every time we release an episode.
Oh. You got called out. All right.
Yeah, yeah. I'm okay with calling out Gary. All right. He deserves it.
Huh?
Yeah. All right, so since without any feedback...
Oh, and if Tom and Cecil are listening, fuck you. But you have a good podcast. All right, now let's continue.
All right, don't forget about the Northwest Freethought Alliance Conference. There's just a few days left, so if you know, by the time this comes out, if you don't live nearby, it's probably be a little late to try to get travel arrangements all worked out. But if you can, come on down. Be sure to register at nwfreethought.org and come see us do a live episode and then hang out with all of us at the bar. It'll be your chance to meet the likes of Hemet Mehta, Daryl Ray, Valerie Tirico, Shelley Siegel, and us.
Yay, cheer.
Yeah. And you could buy Wesley a belated birthday beer or me a pre-birthday beer.
I don't give a fuck what the reason is. Just buy me a beer.
All right. On that note, let's go ahead and move on to the Foundation Beyond Belief. Still pimping them. And we'll continue to until they reach their goal. So.
Goddamn right. Sign up.
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
So this day in history, March 21st, 1980, Wesley, your not-so-humble host, is born in Oakland, California. All right, so, yeah, I was born down there, raised in the East Bay area, around Walnut Creek in Dublin, you know, when there were still walnut trees in the area, and before the BART was as big as it is, BART being the Bay Area Rapid Transit.
Hmm.
Anyways, yeah, so hooray, it's my birthday, I'm another year older or something, so yay for me.
Yay, Wesley!
Yay! Okay, and to go back a bit, and this day in history, March 21st, 1800, Pope Pius VII was crowned with a papier-mâché tiara. So, that yeah, this is kind of cute, in a way. The church was in shambles after the French invaded Italy, and Pope Pius VI died. When that happened, the predecessor didn't have access to the papal jewels, so locals actually made a cute little papier-mâché papal tiara that Pius VII used, and was actually used for all the popes up until 1845. So, yeah, there was a time when the popes didn't have all that gold surrounding them.
Mm-hmm. Napoleon, you know. Napoleon wasn't too big of a fan of the Catholic Church and the papal authority, and, you know, had his a little bit of fun there.
Yeah. So, good on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you called this one cute, and, yeah, you know, papal tiaras and slippers, you know, they are kind of cute.
Well, to see somebody that's usually wearing the either gold or those giant linen hats, yeah, to see him wearing something that a first grader or kindergartner could have made, yeah, you know what?
Hell yeah.
Just kind of brings him back down to earth for a little while. But, you know, Napoleon wasn't that religious of a gent, but he sure questioned the church quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was definitely a believer, but I don't think he went to church unless he was taking it over.
Yeah, you know, that was back in the days where just about everybody was a believer because, you know, science wasn't all that developed yet. It was a lot less...
refined?
Less feasible to... the need for the God of the Gaps was so large that... it seemed much plausible. more plausible and necessary.
Yeah.
But with the amount of scientific advancement since then, the God of the Gaps has shrunk so much that, you know, deism and the like isn't all that useful.
Yeah.
Still popular, but not that useful.
Deism. Bah. Weak sauce. Man.
Yeah.
All right. So, moving on. This day in history, again, March 21st, 1980, Carter, our President Carter, tells our Olympic athletes that we are going to boycott the Olympics. This is one of those little kind of odd ones. The Moscow Olympics that were going to take place in 1980, they're just basically going to stay out of it for political reasons. Mostly because of the Soviet Union getting involved in Afghanistan in 79. Usually the Olympics is a place to keep politics out of the realm for at least a couple weeks, but didn't happen. And mm-hmm. Turns out that the Russians actually did it to us in 1984. That was the LA Olympics, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, to try and make the same statement. Whatever, okay.
Yeah, don't do that with the Olympics.
Yeah, keep your shit out of that. I mean, even Hitler went to the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
Just to show off all his great Aryans.
Well, heck, the U.S. still sent a team to the Olympics under Hitler.
Yeah. That was, what, 39?
I
want to say it was 39.
Even number years.
Oh, sorry, 40, then 40.
Let's see. Hitler Olympics. 1936. He had come to power, hadn't started his conquest of Europe, and was so proud that, or so sure that his pure Aryan team would kick everybody's asses, and no.
Yeah, no. Because
was it some of the I think some of the foot races, Black Americans won.
Yeah, long jump also.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so yeah, created an awesome little thing there.
That just makes absolutely no sense because it's not like the Germans cleaned up in 32 or 28. I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So why would he expect them, like, oh, I'm in power, they're going to win. Okay, whatevers.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, again, off the topic.
Oh, yes. Yes.
This day in history, 1989, Sports Illustrated runs a story of Pete Rose gambling on baseball on his own team. Yeah. Yet another time I really don't care about sports. Moving on. This one's actually kind of interesting and surprising that it took this long. This day in history, 1999. Bertrand Piccard and Brian Jones become the first people to circumnavigate the Earth in a hot air balloon. So, yeah, I'm sure this isn't one of those little woven grass baskets that we're all used to seeing, but hot damn. Well, it's cool that, you know, they finally got into the Guinness Book of World Records and hearts of minds of young ballooning enthusiasts everywhere.
Yes, yes. Bretling Orbiter 3 is what they used. 19 days, 21 hours, 47 minutes.
19 days.
Switzerland to Egypt.
And that's around the world?
Yeah, close enough.
I'm guessing that they couldn't really steer the balloon, so hopefully it went around the world, but that's your closest longitude.
Yeah.
And for you, the listeners of Atheist Nomads, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. You might want to check out Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality by Dr. Daryl Ray, narrated by Dr. Daryl Ray. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/atheistnomads. Again, that's audibletrial.com/atheistnomads for your free audiobook.
Science and technology.
Ow.
First off, we've got human brain cells making mice smarter. A team of neuroscientists grafted some human brain cells into the brains of mice, and their learning abilities and memory greatly surpassed that of just a standard mouse with, you know, only mouse brains. Anyway, what they did was, rather than going the conventional route of transplanting neurons, they transplanted a different type of brain cell, the glia. And what's interesting is the glia is incapable of electrical signaling. Traditionally, the view, or the conventional view that's been held, is that the brain's processing power is handled by those electrical signals through the neurons. But by adding human glia into a mouse brain, and that increasing its intelligence levels and memory levels, that definitely suggests that non-electric brain cells do contribute significantly to the processing power of the brain.
While cool, this still kind of scares me.
Why?
I mean, you've read or watched Hitchhiker's Guide by Douglas Adams?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mice are transdimensional beings. They're already very smart. Do we need to help them along?
Pinky in the brain?
Fuck. We're screwed.
Oh. Fun times. Next up, a team of geologists and climate scientists have been looking at what makes the current global warming unique. And to help figure this out, what they found is that current temperatures are warmer than they've been 75% of the time out of the last 11,000 years. And just looking at the last 7,000 years, because that's when the last ice age ended. Now, that does mean that 25% of the time it has been warmer than it is now. So this isn't the hottest it's been. But what's unique is it's been, you know, those earlier warming periods were slow. And this one is at a much, much more rapid pace. So at the rate that it's going, and without anything being readily available to slow down that process or stop it, it does present the possibility that very soon we could be hitting an 11,000-year record.
Fuck.
Yeah,
this is just not good for our crops or us as a species. Crops are made to grow in very narrow temperature bands. So unless we can do something to gen modify our foods even more to grow in different temperatures, that's really going to screw us over.
Yeah. Well, you know, and if you look at it, after the Ice Age, things warmed up, and then about 5,000 years ago started cooling down a little bit. Well, 5,000 years ago puts us not too far past the agricultural revolution. And so, yes, while that started during a warm period, a very warm period, we've got 5,000 years of agriculture adapting it to colder climates. And yeah, those crops are very carefully designed through, you know, even if you're not looking at genetically modified foods, the amount of artificial selection that goes into those crops, they've undergone lots and lots of modification. And sure.
If you get seeds that won't grow in a cold temperature, they won't grow. The ones that do grow obviously can handle the cold temperature, and you know, it gets warmer, it gets colder. Some live, some die.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of pretty basic shit there.
So unless you want all of agriculture taking place in Canada, Alaska, and Siberia, we might want to turn things around a little bit.
Yeah, in our new beachfront property, like in Montana.
At the center of the Milky Way is a giant black hole. This black hole is known as Sagittarius A star. That's A asterisk, but it's pronounced A star, which is really pretty cool. It's about 4 million times more massive than our sun, and astronomers have noticed a gas cloud getting about ready to be absorbed by it.
Sweet.
And this gas cloud, based on their analysis of it so far, it looks like it's about 3 times the mass of the Earth. So it's really not very big, but it's already beginning to change shape as it gets skewed by the black hole's gravity. And it's going to be a really awesome opportunity that they're going to be watching as close as possible to see what exactly happens to this as it gets sucked in. And over the course of the next couple of years, they'll be able to learn a whole lot about how black holes work. And it's going to be especially interesting because it's watching a cloud, not a planet, but a cloud. And so with that added fluidity to it and less density to it, it's going to make it so that you can see a lot more action going on.
I can't wait, man. But Seriously, black holes are always badass. Mm-hmm. Ever since my mom showed me this cheesy movie called The Black Hole, way back in the day, they've just been very intriguing, and I just like studying them. So yeah. Just to see this massive emptiness in space that just eats shit is kind of cool, because you can't really look at a black hole. You just see this big black spot.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, cool.
Yeah.
It's time for lunch. Come on.
That's it for science.
Yay.
The ACLU filed a lawsuit in eastern Missouri against the Salem Public Library in Salem, Missouri. The lawsuit was over a Native American woman who went to the library and was trying to research her own heritage. But what she found was the web filters at the library prevented access to sites dealing with the Wiccan Church, the Wikipedia entry for Wicca, astrology.com, the Encyclopedia on Death and Dying, and even some sites dealing with Native American beliefs. And as soon as they filed the suit, the library did change their filter settings to take that off. But the federal judge did rule in the ACLU and Anaka Hunter's favor, saying that her First Amendment rights were violated and that the library had screwed up by categorizing things as occult or criminal and banning those sites. And he has ordered that those filters not be turned back on.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, libraries are required by federal law to block certain sexually explicit content, but they're not supposed to be blocking access to information on different cultures, beliefs, and the like.
Yeah, because that basically shows favor towards one group or another.
Mm-hmm. You know, religious liberty means the government has to be not involved, that all ideas are equally acceptable, at least in the eyes of the state.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
Hooray, Anaka.
Good for the ACLU. In Bangladesh, four people, at least as of February 22, so this article is a little bit old, but four people had already died in clashes between protesters and the police in Bangladesh. And what prompted all of this was four quote-unquote atheist bloggers in the country that were just speaking out against Islam and Muhammad, and it really, really pissed off the people in that country. They have been, the riots have been absolutely insane. You know, Pal Ashbari, at least 4,000 protesters attacked police with homemade bombs and sticks.
Is this really how the religion of peace should be acting? I mean, officers are out there retaliating with rubber bullets and tear gas to try and neutralize this shit. Holy crap. I mean, seriously, that this is what you got? You guys are assholes.
Mm-hmm. When somebody speaks out against your beliefs, the appropriate type of response is to speak out against their statements. Responding to words with violence isn't cool. That is a horrible, horrible overreaction. And really just shows, really, it's pure evil.
Yeah, I mean, Sam, what, 200 people have been injured? Come on. Is this really the way you're going to act? Ew.
Mm-hmm.
All I got to say, if you atheist bloggers in Bangladesh ever hear this, good on ya, and keep your fucking head down.
Yes. Keep your head down, keep confidential, use as many, many tools as possible to make it so that won't link to you, yes.
Look up Tor, it's great.
Tails is a Debian-based live CD, it also works on a USB key, provides complete internet anonymity. So if you use that in a public site, you can actually make it so that it's got settings to where you can make it look like Windows XP, so it blends in a little better. But it does use Tor to provide complete anonymity. I highly recommend something like that. And especially if you're doing it on a CD, once you reboot the computer, there's no trace left on it.
Oh, sweet.
If you use USB, make sure you don't do any kind of a persistent setup. Persistent being where you have persistent user space where you can save files. You would leave no trace anywhere. Nothing would be, yeah. Highly recommend this to anybody with any kind of a alternative view in a place like those Muslim countries in the Middle East and Asia.
Awesome.
Yes.
Next up,
the top cardinal in the United Kingdom has been Cardinal Keith O'Brien has been forced to resign.
Say it ain't so.
Yeah. Three priests, as well as a former priest in Scotland, have reported that Cardinal O'Brien seduced them.
Oh, goodness.
Seduced them and used his power to coerce them into having sex with him. But it really just shows how incredibly fucked up so much that's going on within Catholicism is. You know, when you suppress sexuality to that extent, it will come out. Those urges, those needs will come out. They will seek satisfaction. And without having a healthy outlet, it's going to come out in very, very bad ways. Keith O'Brien has been one of the loudest critics of gay rights in Britain. And he's gay himself.
Yeah. Methink he doth protest too much.
And when you look at it, the way the Catholic system's set up with their seven sacraments, each person can only do six. And the options to satisfy some of those is celibacy or marriage. And so anybody who wouldn't want to marry any man who wouldn't want to marry a woman, i.e. gay or a pedophile or something else that deviates from the preferred Catholic norm, would be naturally drawn to something that's viewed as a socially acceptable way of getting around that. So they have an alternative, and that's the priesthood, where they're not allowed to have sex. And it is a horribly, horribly, poorly thought out system. You know, if you look at the historical development of the celibacy for clergy, it was just around making sure that church leaders wouldn't have heirs that could inherit their property. Hmm. That's not a problem we really need to be addressing in this day and age.
When Pope John Paul died, you know, he went up to heaven and Gabriel's up there asking him, you know, of course you're getting into the heaven, but is there one thing that you have always wanted to see or do? Pope John Paul's thought about it for a second. It's like, I would love to see the Bible in its original word. And so Gabriel brings him into this little room, shows him the book, and lets him be for a while. About an hour later or so, Gabriel walks back in, and that's just about the time that, you know, he sees Pope John Paul slap his forehead and say, "Ah, the word is celebrate."
Oh, yeah. That is awesome.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's all I got.
Yeah. So, yeah, Keith O'Brien's a self-hating closet case asshole.
Bigot of the year by the gay rights charity group Stonewall.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wonder if they'll let him be a member now. You're like, I don't think you're, you know what, you're gay? Yeah. All right. Yeah. We're still not letting you join.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Next up, Terry James was an employee at San Diego Christian College in California, and she got fired for getting pregnant. Now, to be a little more precise, she was fired for having premarital sex, the evidence of which was she was pregnant. And the person who knocked her up was her then fiance.
Well, which is generally, I would say, fine. Mm-hmm. But there was an odd thing about it, is that she also gave a job to her fiance. So there's a little bit of nepotism, if you want to call it that.
Well, it wasn't that she did. After they fired her, the college offered her fiancé a job.
Oh.
Yeah.
It'd be funny if it was her job.
You know, she'd signed a 2-page contract with the college that included that she wouldn't engage in sexually immoral behavior, including premarital sex. So with that statement, it would make it so that, or that contract, it would make it so that the college would have legal recourse or a legal defense in the lawsuit. But by offering her fiance a job, who obviously he's also engaged in premarital sex quite recently, that's going to make it so that in the court it will look a lot more like she was fired for getting pregnant, not fired for having premarital sex. There's been a number of court cases recently with this type of stuff, with teachers at religious schools. One last year in Florida, an appeals court ruled that the teacher, or the case would go to trial because it really looked like they got fired so they wouldn't have to find a replacement for her while she was on maternity leave. There was one a little bit earlier in Texas where she even offered to get married a little bit earlier to try to keep her job, but the school said no. And there was a Catholic school in Ohio a couple years ago. Not even the same type of situation. They fired the woman for getting pregnant by artificial insemination. And it creates a weird little gray area between, is this sexist pregnancy discrimination or is it, or what is it? But in this case, it's very clear since they offered, with offering her actually now husband, a job.
Yeah, that lady in Ohio, you know, she had in vitro fertilization, but all she had to do is turn around and say, "Look, virgin birth. Come on. What are you doing?" Sorry.
I was just looking to see if it if the article said anything about whether or not she was married. It doesn't. The in vitro one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
I'm making the bad mistake of looking through the comments.
Oh, don't do that.
Most people are siding with the Christians. Even on HuffPo. Come on. Wow.
Are they missing the obvious hypocrisy?
Apparently.
Yeah. Now, what's really interesting here is the type of church that would be having a rule against premarital sex would also be one that would more likely than not, and vastly more likely than not, have rules against employees having abortions. But if she'd gotten an abortion, she'd still have a job.
Well, so long as she didn't tell them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sure, you can't hide a pregnancy forever, but man, oh man.
You know, she didn't volunteer the information that she was pregnant.
Well, I'm sure it just kind of showed up after a while.
Yeah. She got pulled in by her supervisor and was asked,
"Are you pregnant or just getting fat?"
Yeah, so it's lots of crazy fucked up stuff going on.
Man, I just don't really see how a person can be fired for being pregnant, even if it's in a contract. I just don't see how you can rule somebody's life that much.
Well, you don't get it because you're an ethical person.
Okay. I try not to be a dick.
I've had plenty of employees get pregnant, get hired while pregnant, not volunteering the information, with it not being known, and I've had you know, fair number of employees, you know, it's often several per year on maternity leave, and yeah, it sucks as an employer to have to deal with that, but that's your employee's right to do that. And not only that, but what kind of a person are you if you're going to be not just condemning one person in this economy to poverty, but two? That's pretty fucked up.
Yep.
And that's what that school was doing.
And now for music, we have Comandando Arturo with Pamelidias el Ateo. I don't know exactly what that means, but Ateo is the atheist. I did run this by Jose, and he said, "Atheist music in Spanish is rare. Good track, though." So, we're going to go with that. I don't exactly know what the lyrics mean, but it's a decent punk rock sound, and it's in Spanish. So, it kind of goes with the whole theme of today's episode. Plus, it's Creative Commons by NCSA. That means you are free to use it, distribute it, play it, whatever the hell you want with it, as long as you give credit to the audience, to the artist, don't use the album for commercial purposes, and you distribute any derivative works under that same license. So, kudos to Comando Arturo for releasing his music under Creative Commons, and check out his stuff. You can find it on Jamendo.com. The link is in the show notes. Here is Comando Arturo with Pamelides el Ateo.
Clavado en la cruz. con el picador.
Joining us now is Jose Alvarado, who runs a small group of Latino atheists in Chicago, Illinois. Jose, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Glad you're here, man.
So the group that you run is specifically targeted towards the Latino population, right?
That's correct. It's called the Chicago Latino Atheists, and it's a group, and I can pretty much count the number of meetups that I've had, so that'll tell me how long the group's been in existence. We over 48, so about 4 years in existence. It's a group that I started, basically I, you know, was a new atheist, as I think a lot of people are, that I've just been meeting so many people in the last couple years. And I think it's, the movement is so nascent that, you know, you just have so many people trying to come out. I'm trying to figure out, you know, specifically what groups or what kind of interests, you know, subset of interests they want to devote their time to, or they want to spend, you know, their time with. So I did start this group called the Chicago Latino Atheists, primarily because I had been out to a couple of the meetup groups, and I didn't see any Latinos at all. And I, you know, Chicago's a big metropolitan area. It's got a big, you know, Latino and specifically a Mexican-American population. I was just really astounded that I had not seen any Latinos at all at any of the meetings. So I said, you know what, let's put it out there. Let's see who's out there. Let's see who's listening and you know, who's interested in you know, seeking fellowship and community and camaraderie in a group like mine. And you know, I put it out there, and it was slow going at first, but it's really picked up significantly, I think, after the Reason Rally. So
That's yeah, awesome. That was definitely a pivotal moment for a lot of people around the country.
Yeah, I think so.
That, and just, you know, knowing that a group's out there. I mean, the Catholic Church kind of gets in the limelight fairly often, so.
They do, and actually even in, you know, just normal everyday happenstances with, you know, things that happen, you know, in the local news cycle. And, you know, we had our Cardinal Francis George that, you know, he had a bout with cancer and things like that. So, you know, those are the kind of things that typically make, you know, the news cycle here, in addition to, of course, all the other, you know, negative press that they've been getting. But, it's not right. It's typically, you know, they do get a lot of good, you know, coverage for, you know, ranging anywhere from mundane things to, you know, pretty significant things. So nothing like that ever exists for the atheist community, as you can imagine, and much less for the Latino atheist community. So we have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. So how is the Latino atheist community different than the, I guess, the atheist community at large? So what makes your group different than the other groups in your area?
the beauty of it is that there's not very much that makes it different. I think something that's a little different from what happens with religious groups that have a tendency to splinter with time. What I've seen that happens with our groups is that we have a tendency to start to reach out or, you know, participate in some of the activities of the different groups, only because I think some of our interests are so aligned. There's so many parallel interests. The things that make us different are really, you know, just cultural things like, specifically in the Mexican American community, the veneration of the Virgen de Guadalupe, which is a Virgin Mary. She's a whole other saint. Really, she's a whole other deity. She possesses certain powers of her own, and she has a whole myth and a whole set of people that were created just to support that myth. So, I mean, it's just one of those things that, you know, if you're not reading things critical about the myths that, you know, pervade your culture, then you're not really aware of what some of the controversies are, right? I mean, talk about teach the controversy. Mm-hmm. There are real controversies to be had. We just don't know about them, and they're really minimized in the media and everywhere else. So.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't think there's very many different things that differentiate us. I attended the Day of Solidarity for the Black Freethinkers here in Chicago. And the conversations that I had with them are very similar conversations that I've had with, you know, the people that come to my group. It's just that I think, you know, we have to recognize on a very basic level, we're still very prone to a lot of those tribal instincts. So as opposed to, criticizing a lot of those tribal instincts so much, I think there is something to be said for making some good use out of them, right?
Yeah.
So as many people as we can attract through these, you know, having different faces up, you know, we get these people in through the door, we get them, you know, attending our groups, you know, we'll get them to meet other people, start building community, getting, you know, some good friendships going with all the different people. Before you know it, you know, I'll see them pop up on different groups or I'll see them at different venues that I go to, different activities that the secular community puts on, especially things like science. And we had a fossil hunt last year that, you know, my daughter and I went to. It was just phenomenal. So those are the kind of things that you start to see. You know, it's a real difference, I think, from what happens in the religious community where they have a tendency to fracture. I've seen the opposite. I've seen, you know, people that, you know, it's their first time coming out. You know, they came to our meeting. Nobody in their family knows that they're an atheist. And before you know it, they're connected to, through our meetings, they're connected to other groups. And before you know it, they're interested in, you know, going to, you know, maybe a talk on, you know, the Higgs boson a couple weeks ago at the Ethical Humanist Society, or they'll, you know, they'll end up, you know, going to another science related talk at the, I know they do some at the, we have a collider here in Batavia, so, a particle collider. So those are the kind of things that, you know, I think just belonging to our group gives them, more exposure to the different groups. And, you know, I don't see any fracturing at all. I see the coming together of a larger community. It just takes time.
So what you're finding is basically you're creating a bridge for people that acknowledges their unique culture, but also allows them to reach out to everybody else.
Right. That's exactly right. I've had some people that came to that have attended the meetup, the group, and, you know, for whatever reason, you know, there are some people that come and maybe they just don't like the group, or they didn't like the topic that we talked about, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But by and large, most people, like 90%, 99% of the people that come, you know, will stay, and then they'll end up, you know, branching out to another group. So it's just great. It's phenomenal to see. The one probably subset of the Latinos or the Hispanics in my community that I need to do a better job of reaching out is just this strictly Spanish-speaking community, which is, as you can tell, they're probably a little bit more insular. It's a harder community to reach out to, only because they're not as connected to, let's say, things like the internet, or maybe just not as connected, right, to what's going on in the larger secular world, or even in, you know, in my group. So
And your meetings, are they in English or Spanish, or
The meetings are in both English and Spanish. Occasionally we'll, you know, maybe watch a short video. Some of it will be in Spanish or English. We tell jokes in Spanish and English. So we encourage both the use of both languages. Personally, I favor English only because that's the language that I went to school in and everything. But I mean, I can converse. I can hold my own in Spanish. So if we get people that just speak Spanish, we can definitely accommodate them and make them feel at home and, you know, get their story out too. So I think that's the most important part, is really just to get their story out and to get them to, you know, start feeling at home in our group.
That's awesome.
I think so.
Yeah.
No, it's been a good, you know, journey these last 4 years. And as successful as I think the group has been in building, the community, I think, you know, now that I've been able to branch out and see what some of the other groups are doing, you know, I realize that there's a lot of work that still needs to be done, and especially in the Hispanic, community, because, you know, it's just the culture really doesn't reflect a lot of critical thinking. You'll still see a lot of, you know, for example, my mother-in-law, she'll watch Univision in Spanish, and in the mornings there's this guy that comes on and he gives the horoscope. And it's funny because you don't really see that. Like if you turn on the Today Show, if you turn on any of those English, you know, you may see that every now and again, maybe as a novelty only, but it's not like this guy that they have, you know, a steady staple of, you know, their programming. It's just something maybe they do as a novelty, but this guy's, you know, he comes on and he, you know, he talks about what your, you know, per your horoscope sign, what you can expect that day or for that month or whatever. And it's pretty funny because, you know, it can apply to everybody in different points of their lives. So it's really meaningless if you think about it. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, but he's actually doing it to be serious, though.
Right. He's doing it to be serious. And what's funny is at the bottom of it, as he's, you know, talking about people's horoscope, at the bottom he'll have a, I don't know if you remember those old, you know, pay per minute phone lines, and it'll say,
yeah,
you know, if you want a more specific horoscope, call this number, you know, charges may apply. It's all in Spanish, and I'm just looking at that, and I'm like, I know my Hispanic community. I know, you know, I know what my Hispanic community is like. I know there's not a lot of people that can afford $5.99 a minute for some guy to go on and talk nonsense for 20 minutes and you know, get hit up with a big phone bill.
Like, but that old Jamaican lady that used to do the horoscopes back in the 80s and shit.
Cleo,
yeah.
Don't ask me why that came back to me. I haven't seen that commercial in years, but yeah.
Right.
Huh.
Well, the Spanish community is very, very Catholic, though, at its base, usually, isn't it?
Very Catholic, yeah. Especially here in larger metropolitan areas, it's very Catholic. It's changing somewhat. I have a good friend who works at the public, and I'm going to mangle the name of his employer, but it's like the public religion and politics research organization. So I know I mangled the name, but he basically, what he does, he's a social scientist, and he studies the phenomena between religion and politics. And he came and talked to us last year, and basically what he found during his studies was that the Catholic community is actually losing, you know, market share, if you will. More of the Pentecostal type religions, you know, more of the lively ones are gaining market share. In addition, of course, to the secular community also gaining some of that market share. But you know, the Pentecostal communities and a lot of the other, you know, jump up and down, run up and down the aisle type denominations are really starting to pick up the steam. There's some controversy about whether the Jehovah's Witnesses are picking up a lot of fresh converts. So I think he is kind of looking into that, you know, real seriously as a social scientist, trying to figure out what some of those trends are. But it's pretty interesting. And hopefully I can, you know, connect him with you guys one of these days, because he's a great resource and a really knowledgeable person to talk to.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
But with that, with those types of trends, the hold of the Catholic Church is loosening. And if the Catholic Church and Hispanic culture can be kind of divorced, then that would open up greater opportunities to make it a lot easier for people just to escape religion altogether.
Yeah, and I think that's happening already with the loss of the confidence in a lot of what's going on in the church. strangely enough, I do see that the church is trying to counteract some of that, not just with what the commercials that you saw, you know, a couple months ago, or I think last year sometime with, you know, come back to your roots or whatever. But, I know even, you know, as long as 10, maybe 12 years ago, my mother, had bought my brother and I, she had bought us tickets to go to this. This was before I was a full out atheist. I was kind of this doubting, you know, yeah, right, but not, didn't have all the arguments down type person. So she bought my brother, my younger brother and I, she bought us tickets to this, revival of sorts, but for the Catholic youth. So it's kind of like a, youth group type thing. And I was just surprised because I showed up and there was people from my community that were there. And there's some of the, you know, teenagers from my community that was there. I was a little bit older because I was out of the military and I was in school. I was in college. So I was kind of the college kid hanging out with, you know, some of the high school crowd, in this event. And, you know, they were just talking in tongues and, you know, they were praying over people and people would fall over with the Holy Spirit. And I was like, oh my God, they, you know, it's totally, you know, it seems like they've, what do they call it? It's like a fundamentalist,
like wing a revival.
Right. It's a fundamentalist wing of the Catholic institution. Mm. It may be one of the ways that they're trying to, you know, I think they're just trying to copy what works. Mm-hmm. I think some of that stuff works. And, there's a church here that's pretty well attended, not too far from where I live. And, you know, I have been there, again, like 10 years ago. And I just remember they had the bands and they had the, they had people, you know, talking and they had, you know, they let loose, I think, a lot more than the traditional church where I grew up, which is, it's called St. Francis of Assisi on the west side of Chicago. And, when I was there, it was a stand up, sit up, you know, stand up, sit down, kneel, stand up, sit down, kneel, yeah, format. And this was a little different. This was more of like really trying to get people to sing and real time, you know, trying to get people to, you know, get into like a good spirit. And I think that sells, you know, just to put it bluntly, I think it does.
No doubt.
Yeah. It just reaches so much of the different
getting people more involved in the process.
Yeah. Right. So much more interactive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the church is, you know, acknowledging that there are some things at work and, you know, they're slow to make their changes, but, you know, when they do make their changes, I mean, they'll do it in grand style. So you never know. The church as I believe as, you know, conservative as the church is, there may be a point in time in the future where they are going to have to face up to the priests, you know, being celibate because it, for whatever reason, it's just not working for them. They're going to have to face up to the fact that, you know, women are going to need to, you know, be more involved, you know, in kind of that priest role. You know, in a way that obviously the church doesn't allow them right now. So, you know, in a way that some of the, you know, the bishops or the reverends right now that, you know, in the Baptist church, you know, you can have a female, you know, as a head of the congregation. You can't have that in Catholic institutions. It's still very conservative. They'll change. They'll change, you know, out of pure necessity. Maybe way off in the future, but, you know, it'll come. And hopefully by then, you know, the atheist community will be a very visible and a very viable alternative to people that, you know, so much so that, you know, it really, those changes won't make much of a difference. So, you know,
it's all good. It's already too little too late now.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. They'll make their changes. It may be too little too late.
That or even just making the changes itself will push people away.
That too. Yeah.
It does.
You're gonna get those people that just want to have the, there's a big push just to get the Latin Mass back in.
Yeah. And you see this, this is, you know, when I mentioned earlier about the whole, the difference between the atheist community and the religious community, that you see that the religious community, successively fractures because of, you know, deep differences in dogma, deep differences in what they are going to fundamentally believe, what they're going to fundamentally follow. Strangely enough, I wasn't an atheist when I did this, but when I was younger, I did do a paper on the Mennonites in Mexico, only because, when I was growing up, my mother, you know, we had a big Mennonite community in Mexico, and my mother always told the stories about how beautiful these women were because they were all blonde and blue-eyed and, you know, fair-skinned. And in the late 90s, when I had an opportunity to visit, I was none too impressed with the beauty, the, you know, the I mean, they were just regular people, you know. But anyway, I digress. That when I did the paper, actually, I found out that the Mennonite community has been progressively migrating to different places because of this split. Because you eventually have a community that, you know, they eventually have to face up to what the what that society that they're living in, the demands that they make on them. So in Canada, for example, you had the Mennonites that, you know, after a while, I guess there's a very conservative wing that they're not for the military service, and the Canadian government eventually got on their back about that and said, you know, you're here, you have to, we're sending people off to die in these wars or whatever, you need to provide some, you know, some persons to, you know, to come out and serve. So some of the community stays, and obviously it's no, you have the community that stays is the less conservative. The community that moves on is typically the most conservative. So then you had them move on to Mexico, and then from Mexico something similar happened. And then I think right now you have the most conservative Mennonite community. I think they're out in Costa Rica or northern South America somewhere. Basically, they, you know, they're like the Jonestown. They live out somewhere isolated from people, and the government pretty much leaves them alone because they're quote unquote developing land that, you know, is otherwise nobody really cares about. But they're excellent farmers, I guess. So they have that knowledge about how to do that.
And they just keep on moving further and further south.
Just keep on moving. And that's the story with religion. You just see it continuously fracturing, continuously, you know, devolving into different varieties and different forms. And, you know, because there is no consistency. There really isn't any consistency in what, you know, what their underlying theme or what the underlying message is. It's just, you know, a group of people trying to adapt to their environment, and, you know, utilizing the you know, the belief system that they inherited, and that, you know, that belief system eventually gets changed by their environment. Some people that didn't want it to change, they move on. People that, the other groups that you know, can handle the change, stay on and become something else.
You know, I'm going to take it back quite a bit here just for a minute. I'm sure. I'm really curious about what you were talking about, like a venerating Mary.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard about it. I've seen it a little bit, but I've never really understood it. Could you tell us about it a bit?
As best as I can understand it, you know, the Virgin Mary is a very strong cultural feature in the Mexican community and the, you know, by extension, the Mexican American community. When I was younger, I know occasionally I got a present, like a pendant, the Virgin Mary. You'll see, you know, some people that get the Virgin Mary tattooed on their back. Looks wicked, looks cool. Yeah. So it's something that, you know, it for whatever reason, it just doesn't seem to lose its, I don't know if you can even call it cool, right? Because the younger kids seem to like it just as much as the older people do. I had an uncle who had the most horrible looking shirt that had the Virgin Mary on it, but he absolutely loved it, you know, and you would think, okay, it's a horrible shirt. Why would you want to get it tattooed in your back? So you wouldn't see these kids wear the horrible shirt, but yet they tattoo it on their backs. it's funny, right? But it's like, It's kind of like that tells you just how strong a cultural feature the Virgin Mary is in the psyche of the you know, Mexican American community and the Mexican community. And I think it has this myth behind it that a lot of people really don't understand. I tried to, you know, delve into a little bit of his details. I did a talk a couple years ago at the group, so some of the details have escaped me since then. But basically, it's just talking about how I think it was a bishop, Zumárraga, the one that Juan Diego had picked these flowers. The Virgin Mary had told him to pick these flowers. He picked the flowers. He went and showed them to the bishop as proof that she had appeared to the Indian Juan Diego. And when he picked the flowers, I guess in his kind of like a poncho looking thing, although it has a different name in Spanish. And then when he threw the flowers on the floor, then you had the picture of the Virgin Mary that was drawn on his, you know, on his poncho, and then they put it up and you know, it was the quote unquote miracle. But what, you know, a lot of people don't understand is that there is a controversy behind, that, you know, supposed miracle. And actually the controversy was investigated by the Catholic Church itself, several hundred years back when they sent out some, investigative team to figure out, you know, whether this was an actual miracle. What they found is that, you know, they couldn't find people to corroborate who this Indian was. He was never mentioned in the bishop, Sumaraga. He was never mentioned in any of his writings, which you would think something as important as a miracle should be included in his memoirs, and it never was. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you start putting, you know, one and one together, and before you realize, I mean, it's no different than a lot of the stories. The construction, right? The construction of this myth is really no different than a lot of the way that a lot of the stories in the Bible themselves are constructed. They're just, you know, people write about them, you know, maybe, you know, a couple dozen years or decades after they happen. And by then, you know, any type of tracing back that you can do to corroborate that story is pretty much gone. And the myth takes hold. And that's basically how the myth of the Virgen de Guadalupe, how she, her myth was able to really take hold in the community.
Yeah. You know, with the iconography that I've seen a couple times I've been to Mexico and in Mexican restaurants and, you know, other places around where I've lived in the Northwest, it seems like she's a much bigger deal than God is.
Yeah. She is. It's weird. And there are some speculations, and I'll say they're speculations because, you know, in all honesty, of course, those things are hard to corroborate, but socially, because we're a race, mestizo race, so we're pretty well mixed between the Indians, and the Spaniards, that there was a lot of, borrowing from the different cultures. And one of the things that was borrowed from the Indian culture was venerating some of these goddesses. And one of them was, and I won't even try to pronounce those names because some of those, Aztec and Mayan names are just beyond my ability to pronounce. But, you know, they were able they borrowed, some of that, iconography, you know, from from the way that they venerated these deities, and even the actual location where the Virgin quote unquote appeared to Juan Diego, some speculate was a place that, you know, they had dedicated years before to one of the female deities in their you know, prior belief system. So, you know, I think it just makes sense that a lot of this stuff was just adapted or co-opted or somehow merged into the Catholic belief system. And, you know, once that happens, then it, you know, it just becomes a lot easier for people to swallow, as opposed to having them relearn a whole new belief system from scratch.
Yeah. Well, that's why Catholicism has been so successful over the last 2000 years, is as it spreads into a new culture, it absorbs it.
Absolutely. Yep. That's it.
You know, just look at Christmas.
Yeah.
That's blending like five different pagan holidays all into one Catholic holiday.
That's it. Yep.
Like, fine, you can celebrate that day, but damn it, you're going to celebrate it because of Jesus, not because of whatever else.
Yeah. Yep. And that happens, all too readily and all too easily in the Hispanic community. I mean, you know, it happens in society at large with the human race. But I think as long as there are other institutions and mainstream institutions, just like, you know, the media that, are promoting, superstition is something viable to think about, you know, vis-a-vis the, you know, those, the astrologers, right, that come on Univision and stuff like that. As long as they have those people out there, it's just going to be a lot easier, I guess, for people to be superstitious, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the whole process of becoming more skeptical is something that, it doesn't happen right away. It's not like an epiphany. I don't know, like, how you guys, if you guys, you know, had a prior belief system or what, you know, how you guys came to atheism, but it's not, the people that I've spoken with, it has not been this, you know, process by which, you know, they came across some symbol and before you knew it, they were converted. It just doesn't happen that way. It happens in incremental steps.
Yeah, no, slowly. No bolt of lightning here.
Nothing, mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Took me 5 years.
Wow. Yeah,
he's a little slow.
No, it took me, you know, when I left the military in 96, when I left in 96, I was still very, you know, superstitious and still had a lot of beliefs. I wasn't this person that was, you know, had to go to church, you know, but I wouldn't be opposed to it if my mom asked me to go. When I left the military, one of the stories that I tell is that, I had a series of events that, took place, as I was, you know, returning from, Virginia Beach back to Chicago. And there was a friend that I hadn't seen in a long time. He was a friend of a friend. And as I was filling up, you know, gas there in Hampton in Virginia, you know, he was a attendant there. And he came out and, he hugged me. We hadn't seen each other in a while. And he said, "Hey, what happened to, you know, your friend Drew?" And, "Hey, I haven't seen him either. I lost his phone number." And he lives, you know, an hour away from Chicago. So I said, "I definitely have to stop for coffee." He gave me his phone number. I didn't have it. And as I was driving to Chicago, lo and behold, about an hour away from Chicago, I had no idea exactly where I was. But I, you know, had a flat tire. And for whatever reason, I didn't have my jack with me. I had lost it. My car just packed, you know, with stuff, and I didn't have my jack with me. So I had no way to change his tire. And basically, just to make a long story short, there was a car that went ran off the road. I helped them get out of the ditch. They took me to the a local gas station, you know, a mile up the road. I called the number that was in my pocket, which was my friend Drew's. Next thing you know, he said, "Oh my God, Jose, I'm like 5 minutes away." So he comes down and he gets me and he helps me change my tire and we get going. We have a cup of coffee, which, you know, exchange, you know, some good laughs, and then I'm on my way. And as I'm driving home, I mean, I have this sense of, you know, how odd that was, how special that was. You know, it's just such a coincidence. And you know, when I got home, I told my mom and she said, "Yes, of course. Can't you see, God, you know, how special it is?" And you know what? It was a moment that I shared with my mother that was very special. And, it's not one that I've been able to replicate since I've been an atheist, because I think I've been on the other side of the coin. I've been able to break down just how, you know, how frequent sometimes coincidence can be, and how at some point or another somebody has to have a coincidence like mm-hmm. that, right? Yeah. So you know, just to make a long story short, I mean, it is one of those things that define those moments and the person that I used to be, but it also defines, you know, sadly enough, some of the things that you do lose, with people in your family, and how I can see why it's so difficult for people to leave, because, you know, even sharing memories like that, you just think back and it no longer really seems like it was you anymore. It just seems like it was this guy that, you know, was super, you know, superstitious, and he was willing to believe things were special and going his way, and you just feel somewhat different now. So I don't know if you guys ever felt that sense, like that oh, yeah. loss for any of those things, but I know I definitely have in my experiences, and I talk to people all the time that, you know, kind of talk about how difficult that is as well.
I've got memories that feel like they're in a fog.
Yeah, yeah, yep, exactly.
It's just this weird tint, or almost like a weird tint to it, or it's just foggy or fuzzy or something, because it doesn't make any sense anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
That glue that was used to make sense of all of it's just gone. And right. And that's what a lot of it comes down to. You know, you run into a coincidence, or have a coincidental situation come up, mm-hmm. and it seems really cool if you view it as something, well, Providence. More than it is. Yeah.
Right. Right. And you know, when you share that with somebody else, I mean, that's an experience in and of itself too. You know, you're sharing that with somebody that you love, and, you know, when you recollect that years later, I mean, that, if you can still, you know, if you still have that same belief system, that same glue that you know, that really brought home that message, I mean, it's, you know, you savor it, you know, just as you did when you first, you know, shared it. And that's loss, you know, so I think that's loss. And I think, kind of redefining some of these relationships is really the challenge, because with my own mother, I've, you know, had some very, spirited discussions. And, you know, to my dismay, you know, my mom has a third grade education, so I try not to be, you know, too harsh. I love her to death and everything. That's the last person in the world you want to see cry. But when you see those tears flowing, I mean, you know, I have to tell my mom, you know, "Mom, I love you, but I mean, I just can't, you know, your crying is not going to make me believe it. I mean, I believe that it hurts. I believe that it hurts that you think that, you know, I'm going to suffer in hell forever, but your crying is not going to make, you know, 1 and 1 equals 6. I mean, it's, that's just not the way it works. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, that's the sad part of the kind of the experience that we go. And the real reason that I think, you know, more than not, we need to foster, we need to develop, we need to, you know, provide this community, the space for people to, you know, be able to come together and at least, you know, share some of these experiences so that, you know, we can get through those difficult moments. Cause there's likely people that, we interact with, and likely communities that, you know, we were once a part of that, you know, we'll never really be able to have the same relationship with again. And, you know, we can't replace that. But I think we can try to be, you know, something that's of value to them that they can look back and they can, really be appreciative that we were there and that we, you know, we were able to share moments with them.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, I found out, a year ago or maybe a year and a half ago that, that you can order Jehovah's Witnesses, online, much like you can pizza. And, I decided last year because they stopped frequenting my home, because I guess there's different kinds of atheists. I don't know, you know, specifically how you guys deal with, you know, the religious folk when they come knocking on your door. You know, some people are, you know, just shut the door. Other people, you know, may be inclined to say a word or two with them. Some people are nasty. Yes. you're still in bed. Yeah. Some people are like Smithers, right? Release the hounds. But, you know, strangely enough, I like talking. I like, I just like talking to these people. I love it. And, you know, I invited in my home. They stopped coming to my home because I would always talk to them outside in front. And, they just stopped coming. So I said, what can I do to get them to come back? So I went on this website. I just did like a little internet short form and, you know, your name and your address and stuff like that. And then they come. Well, they showed up and I entertained them last year, January, for a full month in January. And I think that was for 4 weekends because I think it was like one of those long months, but, and I just loved it. I loved every single minute. My family hated it. I think they were pissed off at me for a full month. And I can see why, right? Cause I mean, it's Sunday morning. We're not church going, you know, even though they're not the rest of my family, they're not atheists, but they're not either the church, they're not the church going type either. But, you know, there they are. They're getting up Sunday morning and they're, you know, they're these guys in suits in the dining room table, right? Not what they want to see at 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. But, to what we were talking about before, about the, you know, about the way that, you know, you come into atheism, it's not like a, it's not this epiphany or anything like that. I mean, they were really convinced, that something horrible must have happened to me, that I must have had some horrible experience with a priest or something. And you know, I had to stop and tell them, I really don't. I have good experiences, good memories, you know, of what my upbringing was like with the church. You know, I feel bad, just horrible for the people that were molested by the priest, but that wasn't my experience with the Catholic Church. We went to Mass and midnight Mass. And I just remember, you know, hanging out in the back of church and talking to people and scoping out the chicks. And, you know, it was great. But, you know, I think that's what they were fishing for. They were really fishing for to get at that one emotional moment so they can help you understand it in more, you know, religious terms. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's just this incremental step by step. You start to make these connections. And before you know it, you look up and you say, well, my God, I'm not, you know, my Darwin, I should say, right? My Darwin, I'm not a believer. I'm an atheist.
It's all cool. I say God all the time.
It's one of those things.
It's a cultural thing.
It's a cultural thing, right?
I was raised Southern Baptist. I mean, that was every other word for us, too.
Wow. So that must have been interesting when you guys came out then, right? Was that, Dustin, was that you raised Baptist?
No, that was Wesley.
No, that was Wesley. West. Okay. Yep.
That was Seventh Adventist.
Seventh Adventist?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Now that, for you guys coming out, from your family, is there a lot of ongoing, repercussions from you guys, or is it something that you just don't?
I guess maybe I got it kind of easy. I came out when I was to myself about 13, to my mom at about 16. And she was kind of same like yours, crying, but uh-huh. you know, she never really got over it. But she died a few years back, and my father, I've just never been close to. Never really known him, so that kind of made it easier.
Huh.
My girlfriend at the time, girlfriends over the years, their families have never had a big problem with it. That, you know, gentle razzing. Other than that, it's been all right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So I've actually had it pretty easy.
My family, I wasn't the first, so not a big deal.
Mm. So you had somebody else pave the way for you then?
Yeah, my older brothers. And so it really helps.
That's what I was, you know, hoping. Cause I, you know, in my family, I had a cousin that, I have a cousin who, you know, came out as an atheist, but I think there is something different. The way that the atheist maybe pre 2000, that came out, you know, that if you were an atheist pre 2000, you're just somebody who didn't believe and you didn't care too much to engage other people. But I've really seen, kind of a difference, not only in the atheists that have come out, you know, since then, but even in myself, just, you know, it just seems like it's no longer good enough anymore just to stay quiet and, you know, just to not, you know, ruffle any feathers and, you know, mind your own business. You know, when you have the, you know, in politics, because I follow a lot of politics, when you have the, you know, policies that are trying to be enacted based on, you know, faulty information, you know, abstinence only type education programs that are just horribly ineffective, and they're, you know, trying to be implemented with taxpayer money. I mean, you have to stand up. You have to say something, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest areas that I've always seen the religious and especially the Catholics at the forefront of just idiocracy. Just, I mean, Catholic condoms work, and here they are pushing an agenda that can kill millions of people.
Right.
And does.
Yeah, and you know, there's other, you know, ways that the superstition just undermines the health, the safety, the, you know, the well-being of the kids in the community. I do have a special disdain for the Jehovah's Witnesses, and even though I entertained them in my house for a month and everything like that, you know, I was very clear that there is one thing that I do really abhor about what they do. I used to be a child abuse and neglect investigator here, subcontracting cases from the state of Illinois. So I had some knowledge of cases that were out there of, I didn't work on any personally, but of the Jehovah's Witnesses that would, because they don't believe in the blood transfusion, that mm-hmm. would put the lives of their children in danger because of that. The way that they got around that was basically they would let the hospital, they would let the doctors particularly, take custody of the children temporarily so that the doctors can do the procedure, and then they would just transfer custody back over to the parents once this thing was done. And then basically they can go back to their elders and say, you know, we didn't approve of it. We didn't want it done, but they took custody. There was nothing that we can do. But I mean, if you're willing to go as far as to, if your belief system is going to take you as far as, you know, undermining the lives of your children, I think that's an obvious red flag. I think it's time for you to think about your beliefs in a way that is a little bit more profound than just believing because my elder told me this is what I should believe.
Man, what a chicken shit way to get around that.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, I think at the very base of humanity, and people are just pragmatic.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, screw it. I don't want my kid to die. I'm going to let the hospital do what they need to and not just like sign custody over and say, oh, I was forced.
Yeah, that's pretty twisted.
Yeah, no, it's, and again, that's just a special disdain that I have for I'm sure there's others out there. I just don't know of them. I haven't had any interaction with them or any, type of specific details about them to get myself riled up about. But this is the one that I, when I see the Jehovah's Witnesses in downtown Chicago recently, they were there preaching. I am of the atheists that do stop and talk to them and engage them and, you know, just say, hey, you know, you guys have to think about what you're saying. You have to think about your beliefs because there are real consequences. You know, your kids could die. I think if they're willing to use that, you know, if they're willing to use the think of the children card, I don't see anything wrong with, rational people using it if it's for a very sound reason. You know,
sure. Have some fun. Look into Christian Scientists. They don't have any medical treatment.
Oh goodness.
Yeah, there's a few other groups like that as well, and I've actually been through a cemetery of one of them.
Oh my goodness.
It is the freakiest thing. You're looking at tombstones that look like they should be from 100 years ago, but no, this is all just the last couple years. You've mm-hmm. got so many babies. It's just horrible.
Right. Yeah, I do think that, you know, superstition, when you understand it correctly, I think that it requires a little bit more activism to root it out, or you know, you can't eradicate it, but you know, you can do a lot to mitigate it. And I think it has to be done, and I think it has to be done by at the grassroots level. You know, I currently belong to a group. I'm the fundraising chair for a group called the Hispanic American Freethinkers. They're out of Reston, Virginia. And David Tamayo is the leader of the group. And basically what they're trying to do, see the Chicago Latino Atheist is more of just a community building type group. It's just a setting, just a place for people to come and you know, find community and, you know, try to, build camaraderie with other like-minded people. But the Hispanic American Freethinkers, what we're trying to do, with this organization is really trying to have more of a national presence. But really try to promote critical thinking, try to promote, you know, rational and the use of logic to understand arguments and to understand, you know, these cultural things that happen specifically to the Latino culture, although I'm sure it could apply everywhere. But, you know, specifically to our culture, we have a lot of, botanicas. We have a lot of those little stores that you go into and, mm-hmm. you know, there's something there that they can sell you for every single ailment that you have. And, you know, this is money that people don't have for, you know, treatment that doesn't work, or, you know, and I think it's just one of those things that if people knew, if they were educated about it, I don't think that we'd see quite as many. I see a lot of actually, tarot card reading and spiritual advisors, even in my neighborhood. There's one a couple blocks not too far from where I live. I'm always surprised that those are still around, but they must still be in business because people must still be going to them. So, you know, if you can have people, you know, support those kind of businesses, if we can just turn around people that would otherwise support those businesses, have them support, you know, organizations like Hispanic American Freethinkers that, you know, are going to give you some, usable tools, not just tools that, you know, eventually serve no purpose other than making people money. But these are real usable tools, you know, the critical thinking skills you know, the way that you can understand, you know, arguments that politicians make and, you know, science-based, understandings. I mean, these are just things that increase our, scientific literacy, which, you know, can do nothing but, you know, help, you know, locally the populations and nationally just can help us, you know, become a much more, enlightened society in a way that I think we're struggling now with, you know, such a high percentage of, you know, Bible thumping, God believing, you know, thrown into, you know, voting for, you know, voting against your interests, I guess is what I'm trying to say what a lot of the Republicans do. They vote against their interests and they don't even understand how. And then when, you know, shit goes bad for them, they don't understand that the reason that it went bad for them is because the reason they don't have health care is because they voted for Bobby Jindal, who, you know, who didn't implement the Obamacare, you know, health care policies that would have helped them out in the tail end. So. It's critical. It's critical that people, you know, we're doing what we can in our community, and then any type of, you know, bridging that we can do to the larger atheist community, you know, we're definitely going to look to make those bridges and those inroads as well. But there's a lot of work to be done in the Latino community, and as much help as any of the listeners can give, you know, go on those websites. And if you see any 401 or 501(c)(3)s out there, I recommend, what's called micro, just like micro lending is, you know, helpful in places like India. Micro donating is helpful too for a lot of these nascent movements, where even something as simple as, you know, giving them, you know, $5 or a dollar here. I mean, if you get a good amount of people to give, you know, you offset the costs of printing business cards, of printing brochures, of updating websites and things like that. Mm-hmm. So,
well, heck, if 100,000 people give you $5, it's $500,000.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of money. I mean, if we can get people in the community to, you know, just to do some of that micro donating, I mean, it's phenomenal. And, it's, you know, what a difference a dollar can make if I sometimes you see some of these YouTube videos and they get as much as, you know, 500,000 hits, a million hits. At that level, if you can get people to give, you know, 50 cents, a dollar, it doesn't seem like much, but it all adds up and it makes a big difference for people that I think, you know, I'm inclined to think are, you know, making a better use of that money than, you know, the Jehovah's Witnesses who are putting out these nice little pamphlets with the Watchtower and, you know, and you know what? They look professional. And if you read them and if you're not, you know, versed in, you know, understanding, you know, evolution or understanding what just, you know, what a theory is and you read it, you know, it makes sense. And it's in a nice presentation and, you know, they were by people in suits and, hey, let me go check them out. So I think the presentation, you know, makes a big difference. So being able to, you know, we have the message. I think we've already won the philosophical arguments, I think, already won on the atheist side. But I think we really need to get out that PR, the public relations side of it, I think right now is the one that we're struggling because we don't have, you know, 2,000 years of experience. So
mm-hmm. That would definitely be the challenge we face.
Yeah.
You know, you just mentioned the Watchtower, and I just thought about this. Whenever I have to do my laundry over at the laundromat, I've been seeing Spanish printed watchtowers lately.
Yeah, they're supposedly they're in like more countries than the Catholic churches or something. I mean, they were throwing out some mad statistics when I had him here for a month, and they were really putting on their seller's hat. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I encourage it for anybody who likes talking about religion and can, and at least, you know, maybe you're not like, you know, of the Christopher Hitchens, like I'm not, right? But you know what? This is how people get good. This is how people learn. This is how you even learn to control yourself sometimes, because a lot of it is just not, a lot of it is getting through the argument without getting yourself pissed off so much so that, you know, you're going to come out like an ass because they say stupid shit, but
yeah.
You know, having them over and you know, being able to talk to them for a good length of time, you know, it just makes all the difference. It really does.
Awesome.
Yeah. I've also noticed in my neighborhood, well, my city, Bremerton, that got a couple of bodegas and like smaller Mexican stores. And mm-hmm. Luckily, though, aside from the great food, I've never seen any like tarot cards or anything else like that. So
yeah, it's a step, step in the right direction, I guess.
No, I live in Boise, and the Hispanic population here is very much centralized to one city.
Mm-hmm.
And like so much so that they've essentially completely taken over that city.
Mm.
When people think of Caldwell, they think, well, it's Mexicans that live there. And granted, of course, right. There's also Colombians and Guatemalans, and you know, but it's yeah, they've focused on living there. It's closer to farmland, and a lot of them are migrant farm workers around here.
Mm-hmm.
So that definitely helps. But it's makes it kind of weird because we have a substantial Hispanic population here that you never see.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm sure it happens in the smaller towns, just like it happens in the, you know, the bigger urban centers. You know, you have people that are lower income and I think it takes more for them to survive, especially in, you know, in this economy. I mean, it just takes them, you know, they have to work more, they have to work longer hours, you know, they have to work in more horrible conditions, and I just can't stress enough that time really is at a premium for people in the lower income brackets. I mean, they don't have the kind of time, you know, I'm lucky that I've always, you know, after graduating college, I've been able to have, you know, good professional level type jobs where, you know, I can have some free time to be able to read or do something like that. You know what? If you're working, you know, 60 hours, you know, in backbreaking labor, the last thing you want to do when you get home is, you know, pick up a book, you know, read, you know, 500 pages of, you know, the God delusion or something on, you know, topics that just may seem like they're of absolutely no relevance at all, to you or your life. You really want to, you know, anything that you read at or you look at or any kind of programming that you consume, it, you know, typically I think that you're going to want something that makes you feel a little bit better or that, you know, can lift your spirit up a little bit higher. So I think that's the big challenge is that, we're really fighting for limited, resources in terms of people's time, especially as it pertains to people in lower income brackets. So, mm-hmm. You know, any kind of, you know, marketing that we can do. And that's why I think the micro donating is going to be important because, you know what, even if we can get, you know, once a year, if, you know, the local atheist groups can manage to raise enough money to put up a billboard sign on, you know, on a bus or something like that. You know, that is enough to at least get a couple people. That's all you need. All you need is just to get a couple people here, a couple people there, to doubt, look into some of these, you know, videos, YouTube videos or, you know, different websites. And a lot of them are pretty good. The Thinking Atheist does a lot of professional style, you know, professionally edited, type, you know, videos that, you know, just talk about different topics and things like that. And it's just, and there's some even funny ones. I don't know if you guys have ever watched any of the dark matter videos or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Dark matter? Yeah.
Yeah, the dark, yeah, just phenomenally funny. I mean, I love those. I absolutely love those. And those are the things that, you know, just having, you know, getting people's foot in the door is the first thing, and it's the hardest thing. Once you do that, I mean, I think it's a done deal for religion, because they just can't compete with forums and venues like YouTube. They can try, but yeah, you know, this is a numbers game. There really is more of us than there are of them.
I'm starting to believe that.
Yeah, yeah. From what I've seen, sometimes in the comments section and things like that, I mean, I really start to feel that there really is more people. They haven't had all the arguments. And I think it's a lot of what, you know, similarly what happened to me. I think I was an atheist before. I just didn't really have my arguments down. I just didn't really understand them. There was a lot about evolution or science that I wasn't sure of. Which is why I, you know, for people that do like to argue or like me, like to talk about religion, to not be afraid to engage people, because sometimes you learn, and if you do it in a way that's humble, I think you can actually, you stand to learn a lot. And one of the things that I didn't know before that I now know after talking to the Jehovah's Witnesses is that there's such a thing called abiogenesis. And when I was arguing evolution with them, they said, yeah, but where does mud come from? Where does all that stuff come from? And I said, you know, I don't know. That's a good question. So, you know, they said goodbye. I studied up that week. The next week they came by and they said, oh, by the way, there's a thing called abiogenesis. So, yeah, I mean, we're trying to, you know, provide this community here so that, you know, people of any, you know, atheist persuasion, I guess, you know, you do have some people that are more, confrontational like myself, but, you know, most people are not going to be. So just to get, you know, more people interested and more people knowledgeable about what some of these arguments are, I think can only help.
Mm-hmm. You know, a couple shows ago, we had Brian Keith Dalton that plays Mr. Deity. If you're familiar with him.
Yeah, yeah, I am.
Awesome guy, but, you know, he was saying when he was having doubts, his religious leader told him that, you know, he should study the other side and see what their argument, i.e. our arguments were. And Brian came back to him was saying, you know, have you heard about this? Have you heard about that? And his religious leader kept on saying, well, basically had never done what he was telling Brian to do. He had never actually studied the other side, and he was just completely at a loss.
Yeah. I think that, you know, where the religion is strongest is where they can coerce you emotionally. And I think that's really been their strength, you know, forever. And I think one of the cruelest things that you can do to people, talking about, you know, studying up on the other side, right? The Amish, you know, do have that practice, and maybe you guys will know exactly what the name of that practice, I can't recall, but it's the practice whereby, you know, you reach a certain age and then they let you leave the community so that you can taste the outside world, and then you make
your decision.
Right, right. But I think that is a very psychologically, I'm not even sure that they understand how powerful that is, but if you allow somebody to leave and they come back on their own merit, I think there is this whole internalizing of that takes place, to where they can no longer say, you know what, I'm Amish just because I was born Amish. I think they come to terms that, you know what, I'm Amish because, you know, I was given the opportunity and I saw the outside world. I didn't like it. It's better here.
I think most of them don't leave because they'd be forced to leave everything that they've ever known.
Exactly.
And all their family.
That's what they don't understand. I think that's the piece that they haven't quite, you know, figured out yet. That's really why they're making that decision. It's not that the outside world is much worse. It's that everything that they've built up, you know, socially, culturally, everything that all the emotions that they've invested in are all placed in this one community, this very insular community. So obviously when you know, obviously when people leave, you know, there's a longing to return to what they know. And so getting back to what I think one of the cruelest things that you can do to people is to isolate them socially. And you do have people that, you know, if they try to come back and they just, you know, or they say, you know what, I'm going to leave the faith, but I still want to come back and visit the family members, and they're cut off completely. I think it's just, it's a tragedy. And you do see, you know, people suffering a lot of emotional anguish because of this. In Japan, I think you have a whole phenomena of bullying that's way different than we experience bullying here in the United States. In the U.S., we experience bully. The prototypical bully is somebody bigger than you, somebody that, you know, pushes you around, slams you into a locker, and you can probably think of like Napoleon Dynamite, right? Being bullied into, you know, being bullied by, you know, people at school. It's different in Japan and in most Asian countries. Basically, they bully you by completely socially ostracizing you to the point that you don't even exist. You can pass by somebody, they don't even acknowledge your existence. And this leads to, you know, people that, you know, higher rates of suicide or something like that. I just remember reading something, you know, along the many things that I scour over the internet. I mean, it was just one of those things that really stuck out to me about the ostracizing people socially. And when I look at what the church does, and when I look at what a lot of the religions do, you know, whenever I see, for example, that the Jehovah's Witnesses are good about this, they'll ostracize you from the community. A lot of people actually benefit from the diversity of the relationships that they have, because if you are belong to a temple of the Jehovah's Witnesses and you decide you no longer want to participate or believe in what they believe, you know what, if you have that diversity in your social connections and, you know, you have Catholic friends and you have other people that will not shun you, all the better for you, you know. And I think the more insular you get within these, you know, within these communities, the tougher that ostracization, and the more damage that does emotionally to people. Yeah. So no, it's just some of those things that kind of resonate with me, that whole social ostracization that, you know, I find, you know, deplorable. As an atheist, really, I have a 5-year-old daughter, if my daughter decided she was going to become a Pentecostal, you know, preacher or something at the age of 18 or 19, I mean, far be it for me to ostracize her. If anything, you know, it would just make our interactions more spirited or something. But in
yeah,
but I don't see myself like excommunicating her from the family or myself, you know, saying that don't ever talk to me again. It's just horrible to build somebody up like that emotionally and then tear them down completely. I think it's disgusting when I see that, or when I've heard it done, right?
Yeah. Well, and you get that from the very insular communities, but you also get it from just some of the subcultures you have in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So like the Mormon subculture or Adventist subculture or some of the ethnic or national subcultures, where if you leave whatever binds you with them, all of a sudden you're just hanging out there on your own.
Right.
And that can be a very, very difficult thing to do.
Which is why I think the Hispanic community, the Latino community, for example, the Latino group, you know, we more or less have one foot in every culture, right? So we do have that diversity. And I think we're much better poised to kind of survive, you know, some of that, you know, ostracization or the nastiness that can come about, right? If you have a friend that all of a sudden doesn't want to talk to you because you're an atheist. I think we're a lot better poised for that. And I guess the reason that I have more concerns for the strictly Spanish communities, because a lot of them are very insular. And especially in the smaller towns, I mean, these can be small groups, tightly knit. And all it takes is for one person to be ostracized and they have nowhere to turn. You know, they may not, you know, have a mastery of the language to be able to forge good relationships or, you know, to be able to, you know, lift themselves up in other ways, like, you know, going to school or something like that. So they depend, a lot more closely on, you know, their specific community than, you know, let's say you or I would. So that my specific concerns and my specific efforts, you know, in the future would be to maybe serve as a bridge for the Spanish speaking communities to, you know, maybe get connected with our group and then on forward to get connected with, you know, other groups that are doing, you know, other interesting things, or just to get their message out, just to get their face out and say, hey, this is who I am and there's nothing wrong with me. I'm an atheist. I speak nothing but Spanish, but, you know, I'm happy. I'm a father. I work, you know, 40 plus hours a week and, you know, I'm not out, you know, doing anything that I shouldn't be doing. I'm a good member of the community and this is what atheism is.
Yeah, maybe something we could pull from the what churches do. Try to set up stuff like ESL classes, or help them get in touch with that.
Yeah, the only problem with a lot of those is that I think as atheists we're a little bit more conscientious of what, you know, we don't want to subvert what they're doing for our purposes. And I think that's one of the things that I have appreciated, actually, because there are members in my community, the wife of one of the main central members of the community, she actually does have teach GED classes, and she did this all on her own, and she's teaching people in the community, but she doesn't, what she does, and I think this is going to be more helpful, is to really teach more critical thinking. So she does the GED part, mm-hmm. but she's also not afraid to, when people ask questions, to make them think a little bit harder about what their cultural or what their social positions may be. But I see this as something different, because if you've ever heard of a lot of the things that take place in Latin America, where you have a lot of missionaries, I mean, they feed people, they clothe people, they, you know, give them English classes, stuff like that. There's a price to pay. What they want you to do is they want you to attend Mass on Sundays. Okay, well, you came and, you know, you came to class a whole week. Guess what? Sunday, now you're required to, you know, to come to Mass, or you're required to, part of the instruction in addition to English is, you know what, we're going to have a class on the Bible or whatever. So we're going to teach you about how we interpret the Bible. And I think it's more genuine to say, you know, well, we're just interested in people getting educated, because the breaking down superstition is a byproduct of education. It's not mm-hmm. the end in itself. It's not the end product that we're trying to push. Education in itself, in any form that you can get it, that is, you know, education that's going to serve a function in terms of like a practical function, like science does, or, you know, like reading does, or like, you know, if you have an English class and they teach you how to, you know, write an essay about what it was that you read and how to interpret it, you know, using some logic, you know, all those things transfer over into politics. They transfer over into what you hear on Sunday, at church. And so long as you're able to make those bridges and help people make those connections, you know, we're not going to get people that, you know, we're not going to convert people in one stroke of an epiphany, but people are going to eventually come out. So I think time is on our side.
And if you give them the tools to access the arguments, there's half the battle right there.
Yeah. Yep. That's true. Yep. And that's the biggest thing. And that's, you know, in developing good interfaces between those logical arguments and those tools, I think is one of the reasons that, you know, we really need to, you know, we really need to get, more groups, and we need to start funding more groups locally, nationally, participating in events and things like that. The only problem is, and I know, you know, personally, I'm, you know, because of all the stuff that, you know, I have going on in the weekends, typically with the family and, you know, just even simple things like just doing house cleaning on the weekend, sometimes will take your, you know, the whole weekend, or a significant portion of the day. It's like, who really has time to do a lot of these things? And there's a lot of good events in Chicago recently in the last year or two. There's a new group that started here. It's called Secular Events, in Chicago. And, I mean, they've just put on some really good events. And, this was I think last year that they'd put on the fossil hunt, and, you know, if they're not putting out events, they're advertising for other people's events. And you know what? All of a sudden, you know, you have more in a weekend than you can possibly do. And I think it's a good thing. It's definitely one of those areas that my group has fallen short, because we haven't really done a lot of things other than you know, just provide community. But I'm hoping that with my involvement with the Hispanic American Freethinkers, that we can begin to, because of their non-for-profit status, that we can start to maybe collect donations and start funding more activities in different times of the day, so that we can get more people interested and more people to come out, more participation. How have you guys seen the participation locally where you guys are at? Do you guys typically get good participation at some of the? Do you guys do a lot of local secular type events, things like that?
Yeah. For me, we've got about 150, almost 160 members on paper for our atheist meetup over here. And we have about 15 to 20 that show up almost every meet. Usually every other Wednesday, we just have like a social, go out for beers, talk shit, and, you know, have a nice time. But Sundays, we usually have like either a trail cleanup that we do for one of the nature trails around here. Also, on the opposite Sunday to that, we'll do bowling and a breakfast.
Okay.
So we're trying to spread it around. I also would like to give, have local people give lectures for my groups on Friday nights whenever I can get those. Mm-hmm. And those are always the best attended events, pushing 40, 50 people.
Yeah.
Whenever I can get a speaker in there.
Yeah, we've got 8 or 9 groups locally here, and total membership between all of them is probably in the, at least on paper, 400 or 500 range.
That's good.
And several of the groups at any given meeting will have 10, 15 people. There's one that's usually in the 30s or 40s.
Wow.
Once a month, getting together at a bar on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. Works out really well.
Right, right. Yeah, and you know what, Chicago, I think we came into the game a little bit later. Last year I was in Washington, D.C., and I was just amazed how many groups they had out there and just how big some of those groups were. I mean, I think one of, you know, just easily there were a handful of groups that every single group had about 400 or 500 people in them. So I think they I don't know if that maybe that has to do with it. It's just a larger metropolitan area, but they do have a lot of secular, a lot of atheist groups and a lot of activities. Recently I was also at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I don't know if you guys still have the camera? So you can see I'm wearing the Fort Bragg.
No, actually, the camera goes out when you add on a third person.
Oh, okay. So I'm wearing a shirt right now. It says Fort Bragg Military Atheist and Secular Humanist, which I was very happy to find because it was nothing like that at all when I was in the Navy. I was in the Navy back in the early 90s. So I think, you know, I've had the opportunity to meet with a lot of different groups, as I travel, you know, professionally around the country for work. I've, always tried to look up some of the local groups. And, one of the things that I've seen is that, you know, this is real grassroots. In how you can tell that it's real grassroots is that nobody has any money. So, you know, again, encouraging, you know, people and listeners to do their little micro donating wherever they see a local atheist group. So but one of the things that I was really happy that Fort Bragg did, I don't know if you guys were aware of the Rock the
Beyond Belief.
Beyond Belief, yeah. Right. They did the Rock Beyond Belief. Just, you know, putting up a secular rock concert kind of as a response to the overtly Christian rock concert that they had previous to that. So, you know, wherever we can find opportunities to put on, you know, some good events or, you know, bring out, like you said, bring on speakers or even have, like, you know, some musicians or something. You know, I think some of those things are phenomenal. They're difficult to do, just from a monetary perspective because, you know, we're all middle class working people and everybody's doing this on the side. It's the strangest phenomena, but it gives me the greatest sense of pleasure to know that, you know, there isn't anybody, you know, really professionally that's doing it outside of the big names like Dawkins. That, you know, he's not doing it professionally, but I mean, he does it in conjunction with, you know, things like book tours and stuff like that.
You know what? I tell you what, the easiest way to get speakers, just get those catalogs from the community college and start calling the professors in there. Start emailing them. Most of them will do it for free. If for nothing else, just to have a class that actually wants to listen to them.
That's true. That is true.
I've got 4 different speakers from my local community college, and it's just surprising how easy it is to get them to come.
Wow. Okay. That's one of the things that I haven't done before. My specific, you know, further challenges, to that. I mean, I can get an English speaking person, but I would love to get, you know, I know there's a scholar named Hector Avalos and he's written several books and he's a, you know, well versed, atheist, but, you know, being able to get, you know, pull from, I guess, just a smaller pool of individuals is the challenge that we really have. So in addition to finding people, I think we also want to try and develop people or people that are maybe on their way to obtaining some sort of positions, maybe a doctoral student or something like that, or that's currently studying physics or something that can speak a little bit more in depth about, you know, the Higgs boson, or at least try to help understand, the layperson, what some of these concepts are. I think one thing, and maybe you guys can help me out with this concept in my mind that I've been thinking, and that is that I think the Catholic Church, well, religion in general, because they've had such a long time in doing this, is that they've actually done a good job in setting up their hierarchy to where, you know, you have people all the way from the Pope, you know, bishops, and all the way on down to the local priests, on down to the deacons, on down to the, you know, the Sunday school teacher, the catechist, of which I was one in the late 90s, all the way on down. So you do have this fairly good continuum, I think, of people that can trickle that message on down.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that is, you know, for academia, it's not really built that way. I mean, you have your well-known communicators like, Neil deGrasse Tyson and Lawrence Krauss. But you really don't get the intermediate, you know, the people in the intermediate phases to interface with the community, to be able to kind of discuss maybe at a simpler level what it is that they're talking about, and on down, right? Then beneath them, you would have people that would talk to the kids, you know, in the same way that the Sunday school or catechists do, and, you know, to try to break it down to them in even simpler levels. So I don't know what you guys think about that. It's something that's been bouncing around in my head. I don't know specifically how successful the atheist community has been in that. In terms of engaging children, I don't think they've been quite as successful. I think we've been good at putting on presentations for like-minded people that probably have already watched tons of videos. But what about, you know, the rest of people, other people that maybe haven't or may not be as versed in, you know, some of the more technical terms or topics that we always talk about, like the different logical fallacies and things?
Well, one big factor is people with children, especially young children, often just don't have time. They don't have the time to be coming out to meetings that we have, and let alone have the time to organize stuff. It'd be them that would be the ones we'd really need to set up the stuff for the children.
Right.
The people that actually understand the needs of a small child. I would be a horrible, horrible person to do that. And it's just one of those things where we don't have that critical mass to get us started. At least not in a lot of places. There are areas that do. I know CFI in Portland, they've got their single groups and their family groups. And they've kind of split it up like that because the families, they, you know, have issues with trying to get babysitting so they can go to the other groups. And so they just set it up so that they're doing family events together. And we do have a group in Boise that's trying to get going with that same type of goal, but it's really difficult to try to put that together.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, like, specifically to the Latino community, the Hispanic community, it's just, you know, I think on average, the average Hispanic person, I think, is a little bit younger than the, it's like a younger demographic, and they tend to have more, more children.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the challenges in my mind that I've been bouncing around. I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to tackle that, but it's definitely something that I think hinders or definitely competes with the time, you know, the limited time that people have. And, my parents had five children. I have four siblings. My mom came from a family. She had 10 plus, you know, siblings, and my dad, you know, had, I think he didn't have quite as many, but my mom's family size, back in that day was, you know, pretty standard. So I think as we start to get more to kind of an optimum, family size, I think some of the extra activities become easier. But as long as we have, you know, these families that are just, you know, even five kids nowadays is just, it's a very big family nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see really how people have the time to, you know, to think deeply or to engage or become active, you know, members of this community. Only because it requires, a little bit more time. It requires you at least to break down some of those barriers that do require you to, you know, to have looked at some of the YouTube videos or to have some level of understanding. I just don't see them having the time to do that. So it's definitely a challenge, and it's one I'm all too happy to work towards, you know, till the day I die, because I think it's such a good it's such a good effort, such a good passion to have to, you know, just try to bring people out of superstition, trying to root them into understanding, you know, more realistically what their actual circumstances are. I can only see good things happening from that.
Yeah, definitely. Now, this has been awesome, but I think we're running out of time.
Yeah. Okay. Just a little side note. You're talking about getting kids involved. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of Camp Quest?
I have. We don't have a Camp Quest locally here in Chicago. I think there's one in Michigan.
There's one in Michigan and Minnesota, yeah. Both sides of you.
Okay.
Those might be good people to reach out to just to get some tips for, because, you know, they work with kids all the time when they have the camps.
Yeah.
Maybe at least give you a few pointers or other groups to look at.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's definitely a lot of work left to be done, a lot of room for improvement. And, you know, as much as I try to get out, you know, still a lot of people in the community that I'd love to meet, that I love to talk to. And I hate to make it sound, you know, so I hope it doesn't come across as cold, but I do want to meet people before they die. And one of the persons that I really wish I would have met, you know, before he passed was Christopher Hitchens. Consequently, Hector Avalos is also sick at this time. I think he has cancer. So, you know, fortunately, it may be too difficult to kind of get him to at least participate in a podcast or try to get him in to sit in on a Skype-type call for our group, you know, on a given Saturday brunch. But, you know, you guys are welcome if you guys are ever in Chicago. Third Saturday of every month, we meet in Oak Park for brunch. And you guys would be our welcome guests if you guys ever found yourself in this neck of the woods.
Awesome.
All right, man. Hey, thanks a lot for joining us, Jose.
Hey, yeah. No problem. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate the message you guys are putting out there. So.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find us online at www.atheistnomads.com. Contact us at contact@atheistnomads.com. Or leave us a voicemail message at 541-203-0666. You can also like us on Facebook or leave us a review on iTunes, Zune, or wherever else you find the podcast. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.